Fellow Story Readers, this episode of my podcast, The Story Explorer, will give you four very different stories I myself wrote in the last 5 or 6 years. I have been a reader almost my whole life, and the last couple of years I got a bit restless, as reading is creative input, and I started to notice the question in my body, where is my creative output? To read a story, to interpret it, is something entirely different as to write a story. Or is it not? I was curious, and I started a new practice. I sat down at my dinner table with in front of me a particular story and picture book about Alice in Wonderland. The images in this book are weird and wonderful. I chose elements from one picture and used those in a story. I sort of reversed my own process. Instead of looking at a story and choosing which elements were meaningful to me, I chose elements from the picture that sparked something in me and I just wrapped words around it. That's almost all. Maybe to read and to write is almost the same practice. The only thing that is different is the direction. It is kind of a reversal of the process. I'd like to share 4 short stories of mine that are each very different in style and subject. Each story is an idea, a thought, or a strong feeling about a subject. Stories are wonderful ways to spark a response in someone else. I've experienced often that when I tell what I feel or think to someone else, I do not get the response I want or need. For me to write a story definitely is powered by the need to feel heard about feelings or thoughts I care about. Brené Brown, whom I think many of you do know, inspired me to start to believe that it is okay and even necessary for me to write down my stories. In her book Rising Strong, she writes the following. The idea that we are wired for story is more than a catchy phrase. Neuroeconomist Paul Zak has found that hearing a story, a narrative with a beginning, middle, and end, causes our brains to release cortisol and oxytocin. These chemicals trigger the uniquely human abilities to connect, empathize, and make meaning. Story is literally in our DNA. So, for you to hear my story, written down in a story, will most probably make us, you the listener and me the teller, connect in a more meaningful way than when I would tell you about my experience. Now, the easy thing for you would be for me to tell you what my idea or feeling was that I wrapped these stories around. Yet, I will not do that for 3 of these stories. These stories are quite light, and I hope they will give many of you a feeling of delight and maybe a little spark to think about what I want to say with this story. The first story is a bit different. It is a heavy subject, and it is one that is not often talked about. So I'd like to tell you a bit more here. From an early age, I have been in the vicinity of a weird and scary animal. I see it as a gruesome grey octopus, covered with ugly yellow warts and with many long tentacles. This creature lived in a room in the house where I grew up. I left that house. Still, these tentacles try to reach me and attach my body to it and pull it near the ugly thing. I fight this pull, and I, even when I lived in that house, have distanced myself from it, so I can be safe and away from this ugliness. In our world, this octopus is called depression. I don't like this creature. I think it is dangerous, and besides being self-destructive, it is often harmful to others. For me to talk about depression, even in a story, is being on slippery ground, as there are so many forms of it, making each experience with creatures like this unique. I understand that my encounter can be a rare one, and maybe that is why I want to tell this story. If you have not met this specific creature, the one that I see as dreadful, grey and gruesome and covered with warts, you will probably not understand the inner being, the mechanism of it. And that's why I had to write this story, to share my experience of an encounter with the tentacles of this particular octopus. I sat down and wrote this story. I call it The Death of a Deathly Pale Girl Who Loved to Eat Dark Chocolate. The Death of a Deathly Pale Girl Who Loved Dark Chocolate. What happens when darkness turns into a paradise? Once upon a time, there was a skinny, tiny, little, deathly pale girl who fell in love with dark chocolate. Now, almost all children fall in love with chocolate, but most of them feast on milk chocolate and stay away from the dark chocolate. Most children find the taste of dark chocolate bitter, but not this girl. This girl is different. She loves the dark chocolate so much, actually, that she makes sure she always has several pieces with her. She gathers them actively. She asks for them and she nicks them. Today we find her sitting deep in the forest at a faraway tree trunk, her back against her trunk, her bum in the hollow space amongst the roots. The roots hold her tight, like a mother who holds her baby when it is still a tiny little thing. She is unable to move. She doesn't mind it. She is stuck. She is captured by this place. She is stuck. She is fine. She eats her treasure. Dark chocolate. The enchanting silver wrapping pieces are everywhere around her. In the air, on the roots, on the grass and in the mud. The silver pieces are reflections of the few sun rays that do land on the ground. The rare rays that do find their way through the branches and leaves. Whenever the girl accidentally looks up, she sees a silver wrapping at the angle where a sun ray just happens to land on a silver wrapping. The shaft of light pierces through her eyes. They are like silver arrows that pierce through her eyes into her mind and slice through her brain. She avoids to meet them as much as she can. She got good at it, really good at it. She knows if she keeps her head down, she won't get pierced by the silver wrappings. Her lips are brown, and the corners of her mouth are smudged with chocolate. Her chin is covered with dark brown spots. Her teeth look rotten. While she sits here devouring dark pieces of delight, her mum is outside in the forest, and she calls her daughter. She hears her mum's voice, but she does not answer. She knows she'll have to stop eating chocolate. She knows she then has to get out of her rooted home, and she does not want to do that. She ignores her mum's voice. Her mum's voice equals the sound of a hummingbird. She hates hummingbirds. She does not answer her mum. She knows her mum will pull her out of her safe place. She knows her mum will drag her back to the house she was born in. Her mum has done this over and over. The getting out of a dark corner horrifies her. She locks out the voice of her mum. She pretends it is not there. She will not answer her. The only person she answers to is Mr. Crow. He is her mentor. He always asks questions. He visits her every morning. His questions capture her attention. His questions are simple. He asks, when, where, and why did you do that? She loves answering those questions. She loves thinking about them and pondering and going over and over them and coming up with answers that do not hold any truth at all. When she answers his questions, her bum tinkles and it deeply connects her to her sitting place, the black earth. She feels connected and linked to the roots holding her like a baby. Each question makes her bum feel more firmly stuck and rooted to her dark, hollow home. Each question makes her feel safer in her dark chair. She hears her mum's voice. Her mum calls her name over and over. She does not answer to her mum. Not anymore. She has hidden herself deep in the dark forest this time. She has learned from her previous mistakes. She does not want to be found by her mom. She has digged herself far and deep in the dark, green, leafy and moist forest. She hides behind the faraway trunk. She is quiet, dead quiet. Her friend, Mr. Crow, can find her, but her mom can't. This time her mom does not find her daughter. Her beautiful daughter never returned from the dark hiding place she made herself. She falls asleep in her dark cave. Her brown mouth smiles. She sleeps so long, the roots grow over her. For one tiny little moment, after a long time, she almost wakes up. She notices some sparks around her. But the minute she starts to move her eyelids, she feels the pain of the sun's arrows. She closes her eyes and the roots expand and lock her in that little piece of heaven. She surrenders to this paradise of darkness, and she never wakes up again. Her mom never finds her. Yet, she still looks for her tiny little girl. Wherever you are now, know she still calls her daughter's name, yet her voice has turned into a whisper. Still, the hummingbirds hear her. The next story I'd like to share with you is totally different. All I'll say is that it is a combination of a coffee moment in a mall in Joburg and an encounter with an old friend earlier. I call it the coffee date. She sits in front of me at a little round table in a city mall. We meet in a fishbowl. Today I meet an old friend. She has clean, sleek, long blonde hair. It is tied tight in a bun, but many of the hairs did not make it into the structure. They have escaped the prison of the hairband that is fixed on her head. Her skin is brown, the color of cardboard, and wrinkled. Her skin reminds me of the bark of an old tree. In South Africa, she is classified as white. She has a full moon face, her eyes craters on its surface. This smiley moon woman's hands move like the wings of a bird in flight. This smiley moon face is dressed in burlap for her party. The old fibered sack falls loose, down from her pointy shoulders. It gives her the room she needs to dance. She takes up all of the space. We sit opposite each other. It is her dance floor. We order coffee. I am her audience. I only see an old friend who dances a one-way dance. Her thin, shiny bangles rattle in the air. She is a predator, and she dances with her prey. I am caught in her headlights. She dances with me, an endless one-way locomotion. Her starred earrings reflect the light that illuminates her stage. The words of her dance are thrown at me. They hook me in. She seeks a connection, but I distance myself. My body withdraws from this performance. I de-link. I create a sphere around her, a bubble. I force it out of me. Inside that bubble, she gestures. She talks. Her bangles shine and rattle. Her hair glows. Her head moves. But the bubble creates a separation. I refuse to be chained in to her solo dance. We do not connect. She floats up, away from me. She keeps gesturing. She has her moment. So be it. It happens. She takes a sip of her coffee. For one moment she looks into my eyes. I feel the chance of a question. I breathe, but there is no sound. She puts her coffee down. Her hands bangle up again. The chance of the connection has passed. Her lips form the words that see only her eye, only a vertical line. I. But it is I who needs her to see me. The bubble stays. The separation is defined. Her hands gesture again. I pick up my handbag. My hand search in the dark void for the little travel kit. I find it. I look down and pick out a needle. I raise my hand. Two fingers hold the needle. I pinch the bubble. It bursts. Liquid splashes. It drips to the ground.
Her hair is wet. Her eyes look down. Her eye lies down. I get up and walk away. She stays at a table, soaked by her own bubble. Her pointy shoulders droop down. Her dance is over. I disappear. Her prey has become a changeling. I become taller with every step I take away from the person I once thought close. The third story I'll share with you is actually an assignment I wrote for my writing coach. If you've listened to my other episodes, you've heard me talk with her already about Karen Jennings' book Crooked Seeds. Barbara Adair is a writer, and because English is not my first language, I approached her to mentor me. When I went to Paris for an African art gallery expedition, she gave me the assignment to sit at a Seine somewhere and write a story. This is that story. A morning walk to the Seine. It is dark. She carefully walks down the stairs of her apartment building. She pushes the door handle down. She leans her body back into the hallway space. She places one foot in front of the door and her hand lets go of the handle. The door opens. She steps into the day and behind her the door bangs closed. She shuffles her feet slowly, step by step. Her body turns left. Her shoulders hunch forward and she plods down the tunneled street. High buildings are lined up on both sides. They have many windows that are lined from left to right and stacked on top of each other. They make her feel tiny, and she becomes aware of a single body moving through the space, while she passes all those different lives. Each life a body, each body a soul, each soul a mind, and each mind a voice in the body. She walks. Her mind travels to the place she has just left. She thinks of the post-children's high-pitched voices. They are a constant reminder of another world that is being lived in at that moment. It is the family and Yusuf. Those souls are the only dents of the outside world that are close enough to tell her she is not alone. While she walks her daily morning journey, her body does not register others. She only focuses on her moving feet and is unable to feel the other lives that pass her by. She takes all the necessary crossings and walks through two more tunneled streets. Her body breathes in the open space of water close by. The stairs down to the river are wide and she feels dislocated from the tunneled streets. Earlier, when she had just started this daily routine, when she was still flexible, she had felt the joy of open space and air. But these last couple of days, she no longer feels this. This morning she feels unbalanced walking down the wide open stairs. But still she manages it. She holds her breath and walks down the stairs. She finds a concrete seat in between the two bridges. Not on the city picnic tables. Never on the picnic tables. They are too dirty. The grey river landing is good to sit on and there her hands can touch the grass. The grass on her fingers feels good. It is like a gentle human tickle, the touch of a person, something long gone. On her right sits a tall black-bodied man with short hair. He has well-defined curves on his arms. He is clean-shaven and has a golden streak in his hair. His sneakers brand new. A black plastic bag rests next to him. It contains white shiny gadgets. In front and above of him is Celine. The tall, skinny and perfectly white female towers high above the black-bodied man. She is frozen on the other side of the water. She is grounded on an old yellow stone castle-like building. Celine is immortalized by the fashionable items she wears. A shiny necklace, huge sunglasses, her face is hidden, her tears are not visible. She wears a black broad belt, and a never-forgotten handbag is also with her. It is bulky and it pulls her towards the grey water depths below her. The white woman's gaze is directed at a young man with the white accessories and a flimsy black plastic bag. He gently cleans the screen of a black phone with a soft purple handkerchief. His lips are closed tight and his eyes are visibly focused. His sneakers are from a starry night sky. His lips move around, they form a message. To someone somewhere in our world. He is dressed in black clothes. His new black phone is huge. He looks at himself on the phone. His lips are closed tight. Celine towers over him. Her brown hair is long and dances in the grey sky that is her background. Both people are closed in by two bridges. The old lady sees grey huge stones stacked together. A horizontal line separates the stones from the blue sky. The grey stones have black half-moons in them. The black half-moons are separated from a lighter, greyish, flat moving surface. It is the Seine. It wrinkles and sparkles in the grey fastness of the river. One bridge has one big black gaping mouth waiting to swallow tiny people on little boats. The other one has three smaller black gaping mouths waiting to spit out the filth that passes through. In between them, constantly crossing their connected midline, are joggers and cyclists and walkers, electric steppers and even trolley walkers. Each one moves with accessories. The lady looks and sees all those bags, scarves, hip bags, backpacks, earpieces, laptop bags, watches, multiple bags, arm phones, and more earpieces that pass her by. She looks and recognizes Nike, Adidas, Levi's. Her ears tell her mind there are many feet that cause a rhythm on a grey tar road. A man covered in sweat. He wears a green shirt. He wears an ultra-thin necklace and a sun cap. Her eyes tell her there are green shoes, blue, orange, even salmon ones. The running clothes are always black. Only the shoes are ever in a color. And there are pigeons, for Paris has many pigeons. The lady hates the pigeons. Rats hide while they live in the dirt, but pigeons spread the filth in the air in plain sight. Her body twitches. The intake is over. She is done with it. It is time to go back to the five rooms that hold her things. She gets up and she starts to find her way back home through the tunneled streets, and her mind calls up the image of her granddaughter. Camilla has climbed the ladder of success so quickly she never sees her anymore. She digs for the looks of the face that is her granddaughter. She is almost home. Her mind leaves her and she only moves her body. The splashes of color disappear. The hate for the pigeons disappears too. Camilla fades even more. The body arrives at the spring green door. She is startled by a tall man with big brown eyes. It is Yusuf. He is leaving their building. He is about to step into the day, but he waits on the threshold and holds the door open so she can enter the dark and he can step into the light. Her body feels the space and her mind is opened. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Yusuf. Bonjour. The last story to tell you is a short, short story. It is actually more of a dream, and I will leave it to you to find the dream from the past that mine resonates. I use it as a contrast to a TV series I watched. I really watched only 1.5 episodes as I really felt strongly against it. In this TV series, there's an heir, and he is such a selfish and horrible creature. And I wanted to create a different heir. I call the story The Heir. The Heir. He is the wealthiest patriarch of Jonatown. He wears a suit, one of the 31 he owns. Each day of the month has its own suit. All suits have a different shade of grey and blue. He has a few black suits. They are all plain, no stripes or patterns. The ties match. The shirt is always immaculate white. On the 15th of the month, the first set goes to the dry cleaner. On the 30th, the second set. After a cold shower of exactly 6 minutes, he eats his breakfast. The elevator takes him down from the penthouse to the entrance hall. He walks through the heavy bullet safety doors of the entrance, onto the street and into the bulletproof car that awaits him. A black car with 8 black windows. The drive takes 10 minutes. He arrives at the building that he knows so well. The 38 floors, the 78 staircases, the 4 elevators, the golden lions on the elevator doors, the black triangle pattern on the marble floor. For 7 years, 6 days a week, he has entered this building. Walked over the floor, passed by the lions, elevated up to the 38th floor and walked through the hallway with glass walls into the boardroom. A seat next to his father. The 11 other chairs are all empty except for Thursdays. He signs all the papers, but his father rules. He transfers huge sums of money. Buildings, high-rises, stadia, marketplaces, railways, hospitals. He is ready. Today his father is dead. He is ready. He waits for the others to come in. He knows each and everyone inside out. Their character, their family, kids, their address, their mistresses, their gambling debts, their toy cars. Today he is done with them. When everyone sits, he stands up. He walks around the big oval table, a pile of files in his hands. He walks behind them and places a file in front of each board member. A pen lies on the right of each place. While he hands out the files, he talks about his father. The great one died, but will live on in this city. Each of them picks up the paper and signs it. He waits till the last one has signed his paper. Follow me up, he says. Jay walks out of the boardroom through the glass tunnel and opens a door. He walks up the staircase. The others follow him. He opens the door at the top of the staircase. The wind howls. He walks out and to the edge of the building. The others follow him. They gather around. He can see them clearly. The black and grey and blue ties, the white shirts. He knows they can't see the color of his tie. He is only black and white for them. To see color will require them to change their position. He says, "We have a mountain to climb after we go through that valley down there." He stands tall. His right arm shapes a triangle on his upper body. The left arm floats in mid-air and one finger points down. The others meet each other in the cave of his hand. He speaks, "You have all been assigned a building. That building now is a place of darkness. You will make it light again. Each building has been allocated a specific amount of money for you to spend on. The gutters and the sewers will be renewed. Two sides of each building will be transformed into lush greenery. The other two sides will have clear and clean windows that will provide light for those who live in it. Each building will have a ground floor that will be used for healthcare and education. Each top floor will be filled with places to dance and make music. This is my dream. You have 2 years to do this. Thank you. You can go now." He turns his back to them and looks over the high rises. He hears them leave. They walk down the 27 steps of the top staircase, through the glass tunnel. They leave the boardroom behind and go down the 38 floors in the 4 elevators. They will look at the golden lions on the elevator doors. They will walk over the black triangle pattern on the marble floor. Jay sees his dream.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.